Our reading this morning is taken from Genesis chapter 48, and it's on page 54 of the Pew Bibles if you want to follow it. Manasseh and Ephraim. Genesis chapter 48. Sometime later, Joseph was told, "Your father is ill." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. When Jacob was told, "Your son Joseph has come to you," Israel rallied his strength and sat up on the bed. Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me and said to me, 'I am going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of peoples. I will give you this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you.' Now then, your two sons born to you in Egypt before I came to you here will be reckoned as mine. Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. Any children born to you after them will be yours. In the territory they inherit, they will be reckoned under the names of their brothers. As I was returning to Paddan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan while we were still on the way, a little distance from Ephrath. So I buried her there beside the road to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. When Israel saw the sons of Joseph, he asked, 'Who are these?' 'They are the sons God has given me here,' Joseph said to his father. Then Israel said, 'Bring them to me, so that I may bless them.' Now Israel's eyes were failing because of old age, and he could hardly see. So Joseph brought his sons close to him, and his father kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, 'I never expected to see your face again, and now God has allowed me to see your children too.' Then Joseph removed them from Israel's knees and bowed down with his face to the ground. And Joseph took both of them, Ephraim on his right towards Israel's left hand, and Manasseh on his left towards Israel's right hand, and brought them close to him. But Israel reached out his right hand and put it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger, and crossing his arms, he put his left hand on Manasseh's head, even though Manasseh was the firstborn. Then he blessed Joseph and said, 'May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly upon the earth.' When Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he was displeased. So he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to him, 'No, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your hand on his head.' But his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations.' He blessed them that day and said, 'In your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh.' So he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, 'I am about to die, but God will be with you and take you back to the land of your fathers. And to you, as one who is over your brothers, I give the ridge of land I took from the Amorites with my sword and my bow.' This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God."
What do you think your last words will be? I know that you often, it used to be in a lot of Hollywood movies, there was a big death scene. It doesn't seem to be the popular thing anymore. But, you know, famous last words. I was thinking mine would probably be, oh, no, ow, or maybe even a swear word or something if I have an accident and die. You know, that might be my famous last words, or something terrible like that. But there's been people that have had some famous words to say, and I've got a few here I want to just read to you. So Bob Marley, I don't know if you know who Bob Marley is. Bob Marley said he was a musician. Money can't buy life. That was his last words. Humphrey Bogart, if you don't know, he's an old actor. I should have never switched from scotch to martinis. That's his famous last words. And then there's this here, Beethoven, the composer. Friends applaud, the comedy is over. This one really struck me. Marie Antoinette, sort of famous for the French queen. If the people are starving, oh well, give them cake to eat if they don't have bread, and was executed. Her famous last words were, "Pardon me, sir, I did not mean to do it." And what she was, as she was walking up to be have her head cut off, she accidentally stood on the executioner's foot and she apologized. So, no, maybe change my view on her, but you know, those were her famous last words. And let's, no quote can be complete. Winston Churchill, I mean, he's got really great one-liners, isn't he? His famous last words were, "I'm bored with it all. I'm bored with it all." You know, he who took the country through World War II, and said, "Never surrender." Finally, surrendered to death. So these are the famous last words, and maybe you're wondering, what are my famous last words? What is my legacy? Normally, in the mornings, first thing I do is make myself a cup of coffee, and I go, "Alexa, news." Okay, so that's a thing, and I try and listen to just the news. And normally, at the end of the news, it's just they have like an obituary. Someone else, you know, served the BBC, did this and that, and then it's summed up, and that's their life, gone and forgotten. So what would your obituary say? Well, you don't. I know this is very depressing to think about. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not a train. There is something brilliant here, because we see it's Jacob's last words, as he really is in the next few chapters. Jacob, who's, it's confusing, he's also called Israel. Jacob, he is giving his last words, and he is doing two things. He's looking backward, and he's looking forward. Now, there's a quote I love by a philosopher called John Locke. He said, "Life can best be understood backwards, but first it has to be lived forwards." And maybe you've had an experience like that. And Jacob has got that experience. He's looking back. And so just a bit of what's going on here, if you just come in. We're looking at a last section of Genesis. We've mostly focused on Joseph, who's quite well known in his own right. But it's also Jacob, and the promise that's a golden thread that's gone throughout the book of Genesis is a promise for a people that are wandering around to try and find a place to live, peace. And they're looking for land, and they're looking for family, and they're looking for blessing. And before we scoff too much about what's this about land, you know, sounds very, you know, like material thinking. Summed up in land is not just a place to live. These people are traveling the whole time. They're nomads. They're looking for home. Now, that might be hopefully that's a good word for you, home. You just want to go home. Yesterday, our neighbor, the weather was nice, and popped his head over and said to me, "You got anything excited planned for today?" And we've just had just a really tough week. And I said, "No." But that's a good thing. We're just staying home. And home should... Even the ideal of home is security, a place to belong, a stability. And that's what they're looking for. And in fact, if it's tied up with God, God promised them, Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, a place of land and descendants and a blessing. And it gets so much more as the Bible goes out. Looking back from the cross, we see that land actually is talking about the kingdom of God. It's a promise of heaven on earth, or it's actually a promise of a relationship with God. And ultimately, it's fulfilled when Jesus comes back to make the world perfect and without pain and death. So that's what's promised in, and tied in are these promises. So Chapter 48, verse 3, Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me and said to me, I am going to make you fruitful, and you will increase your numbers. I will make your community of people, and I will give you this land as an everlasting possession for you and your descendants after you. So he reminds Joseph of this promise. In fact, in the end, both Jacob and Joseph are quite clear. They don't want to have their remains just staying in Egypt, that one day, whenever the family moves out, they want them to be buried in this land. So he's got that in mind, and he reminds Joseph of that. And he prays for his family to come, that they will live in this land. He prays for a family. And then we see something a bit controversial happen, for that we might not get it, but in chapter 4, verse 8, there Joseph now is bringing his sons. I mean, we mustn't forget that these... What happened was Jacob, for 22 years, was lied to by his sons and told that his brother was dead. Can you imagine if one of your children did that? Just the brokenness and the hurt that he must carry for that. And thankfully, now he's had 17 years with Joseph, good years with him. In fact, earlier on, when he arrives and he meets Pharaoh, this is in chapter 47, when he meets Pharaoh, Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my pilgrimage are 130, which to us sounds a lot, but his years are a lot less compared to his family members. By the way, if you're wondering about years, it seems to be that from sort of the generations go down in the Bible, the years slowly get less. And it can be even backed up in science. Well, I'm saying that things wind down. So people were sort of, in biblical times, doing way better. And then it slowly gets worse. But the point is, he says this, my years have been few and difficult. I mean, that's a grumpy old man, isn't it? He's bitter. But he's had 17 years now. This is 17 years later. And he seems to have a more balanced look. He's looking back now and he can see God's goodness in certain situations, but he promises that they will have a family that will carry on, and he blesses these two sons, and he does something that's strange. Joseph says he's upset. It's a bit more word livid, and you can imagine if you're a parent, that anger of this is what it should be deserved for my child. You know, this is their birthright. This, or whatever the case. And it looks like his oldest is being cheated out of that. And it's a big thing culturally to them. And though Jacob can't really see, he can see something better. And he's just how God always uses. He turns things upside down and changes things. And both of these boys are going to be blessed. In fact, you see, compared to what some of other Jacob's sons get, that's in chapter 49. The thing is, they're going to be counted as Jacob's sons. Their inheritance status has been bumped up, and they're going to be a blessing and to go for. And he blesses them and he looks forward. And the strange thing is, if we look back, you're going, well, wait a minute. No, Joseph grew up in Egypt. In fact, these guys, Joseph's sons, they were Egyptian in culture in many ways. They had Egyptian names. You should let them decide what religion they want. I mean, surely you should. Joseph shouldn't have sort of pushed his God down their throats, and he should have just let them grow up and know all their options, and you know, so they can choose which Egyptian God they want to worship, or they want to worship the God of the Bible. It's just kind of assumed here that this is going to be their God, and of course God has made a huge impact on Joseph's life, so there's no way he knows he's the true God. But it's a point of God uses families to grow his kingdom. One person made that I was reading about this. And if you look back, if you're a Christian, there might be someone in your family that had an influence. It might be that you're the first one in your family, but there might be an impact going forward. See, God uses families, and it might be that one of your children, I met a man that was in his 70s, and he said that from, I think, 12 years old, he told his parents he didn't want anything to do with it. And up until only the year, he was 70, and only last year he became a Christian. And he remembered something that was from when he was 12. And it took him all those years to become a Christian. And he suddenly went, my gran, what she was talking about totally makes sense now. And so you don't know when it's going to happen, but God uses families, and we believe that that's why we have baptism? Are we asking that this child one day, the water that symbolizes the cleaning of washing will one day be a reality? And parents are just saying, God, this is the most important thing. I want my child to know you. And God uses families here. So just thought, as a step back, that's taken encouragement. You don't know how God works. People still make their own decisions. But God has structured that parents and grandparents have an influence greater than they think on the next generation. But these promises are to them, and he's looking forward. He's saying that that he will be their God. And then he does something. This is really what I want to focus on. He looks back. He says this. So this is 15. Then he blessed Joseph and said, "May the God whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys." So he's saying, may this God be their God in the future. So that's what he's praying. Those are his dying words. That's his last wish. But there's something strange here. How can he say, he's been my shepherd and he has delivered me from all harm? Some translations say he's delivered me from all evil. It's just moral evil. It's brokenness in this world. He's been my shepherd and he's delivered me from evil. Jacob's life, if you look back, he went to go, problems in the home, went to go stay with his uncle, relative, fell in love with this girl called Rachel, wanted to marry, and he said, fine, you can do that, but you need to work 7 years in sort of slavery for me, your contract's tied in, and did that, and then the father pulled the switcheroo and gave him one of his other daughters, and then he had to work another 7 years to get Rachel, the love of his life, and then she dies. And then he has children that cheat and betray. He thought he loses his children. I mean, how's that being protected from harm? But you see, what he's looking back, he's saying that he has helped me through this time. See, what Jacob is looking back now, and this is something that only someone that's older can do. He can look back and say, none of my pain's been wasted. None of my pain's been wasted. And the promise to us as Christians, because Romans 8 picks us up, it talks about 8:28, that your suffering will be used for good. Now, I don't want to make less of your suffering. I don't know what you've gone through. I don't know what you're going through. And you might not even understand it this side of heaven. But God will use your pain for good. And so if someone's not a Christian, the pain is just useless. But if someone is a Christian, they're following God, your pain won't be wasted. That heartbreak, and maybe there's that first love heartbreak or the betrayal of someone, maybe if it's a marriage breakup, maybe it's death, God will use that. He's not the one sending it. He uses it. I mean, he allows it. But a friend of mine, he's into martial arts. And I said to him, oh, no, I'm trying to explain this passage. And he said, phone my sensei. And his sensei, that's his martial arts guy, told me there's something called Aikido, and I can't do it. But Aikido is this discipline that says it doesn't matter if you're a little frail girl, if a huge big guy comes at you, you can beat him. Because what it does is it sort of uses the own person's strength on them. So I don't know how to do it, but like imagine a big guy come running in, you do something and they flick over and they fall down. And that's an Aikido move. I don't know if I've got it right. If you're into martial arts, you can come correct me. But the thing is, God uses pain as an Aikido move. He takes the bad things and he will turn it around, your suffering, your brokenness, your hurt, and you'll use it for something good. Jacob's testifying to this, and we know that this is a testimony that's true for all Christians because of later on in Romans. Your pain won't be wasted. I remember there's a man called Frank who I got friends with. He passed away a couple of months ago. Frank, I went to a church in South Africa, and I had to go and sit at this man's wife's bedside with him just because she was dying, and sadly she passed away. And then Frank was suffering, and I just didn't come to our house for supper, and we became friends. And Frank really grew as a Christian, but he looked back and he said to me, we were going through, this was in South Africa, some real financially tough times, and he said, God's looked after me. It's been bit by bit, but he's helped me pay the phone bill. He's helped me pay that. And I thought, what's he talking about? You know, and he had that hindsight of looking back. He was older, and if you consider yourself an older person, there is something you can share with people. If you've walked with God, that can be helpful. And younger people, and maybe and there's always someone older than you, and always someone younger than you. That's something to learn. Just listen. There's someone that's might have spent 20, 30, 40 years walking with God through life. They can share their testimony and saying, look, he's been there. And the word that he uses is shepherd. And, you know, we often think of, it's like little cute biblical pictures of sheep. But the thing is, when Jacob appears to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, what's your occupation? He says, we're shepherds. And my family and descendants have been shepherds. My sons are shepherds. This is something that's not just a picture. This is saying he knows exactly what it means to be a shepherd. He knows what it means to deal with sheep that can be great, can be stupid, can need help, are helpless. He is talking practically here. And in fact, the other person that uses a picture of God being a shepherd is the guy that wrote that famous song, Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." He was a shepherd. And so when he's using this, it's not detached. He's saying, he's walked with me, he's guided me, he's helped me. My only experience of sheep, I've seen sheep around, but I went up to the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides in Scotland, and I was there for a week with my family. Long ago, it was a possible job thing, but we looked out in this house, and there's no trees on this island because of the wind. It's beautiful. We went there in summer. The beach, I mean, there's beaches, they're amazing. But the weirdest thing is on the entire island, as I looked across this flat thing, I just saw sheep, and they're all facing the exact same direction. It looked like something out of like a horror movie or something. All the sheep just standing, and then they turn their face. And I think afterwards it was the wind, that they're trying to sort of get the wind to go down. But it was weird looking. Sheep are weird, and they need help. And he's saying, God's been like that to me. Every time he's walked with me. And he didn't get it right. Jacob got it wrong a lot of the time. But he's looking back and he's saying, he's the shepherd that has redeemed me from evil. That's what he's looking back at. That's sort of the message I want you to see, that God is the shepherd. He redeems you from evil. He guides you through that pain if you're a Christian. But it's more than that. So remember I said life can best be understood backwards, but first it has to live forwards. We are standing a lot more forward than Jacob looking back. We see how these promises tie out, how eventually it means that because Joseph and Jacob were separated, that God orchestrated events that meant that Jacob's family be saved, but the whole sort of known world at that time, because God gave Joseph the vision about famine, and the known world meant that it was rescued because of that suffering. And they were reunited. But because of that, that meant that the nation of Israel, Jacob's descendants, which are only 70 at that time, could survive. And if you turn to the next chapter, you see that family has grown in the book of Exodus to a huge nation. And because of that nation going through so much trouble, that one day a boy would be born to a carpenter, and would have a place, and the Son of God would come to earth and then die and be separated from his father so that he could be our shepherd forever. On the cross where Jesus dealt with our sin, he took our place, he took the evil on himself. He cried out, Dad, where are you? Imagine how God's heart broke when the sin of the world came on Jesus and he had to separate from his son. The most perfect relationship all of his was ripped apart so that you can have God as your shepherd forever, walking with you through every single pain and using your pain not to be wasted. And so we can say Jesus is our redeemer, our shepherd. He's our rescuer. He's one that guides us through it. What would your last words be as you look back? I suppose it doesn't really matter what you say. What about your obituary? You see, it doesn't matter what you say, even what you do. You might be a great person or a scumbag or mess up, but what matters is who you trust in. That's what really matters. That's the legacy we want to pray for our children and our grandchildren. That's all we want. I don't care how successful they are, or even if they end up in jail, you want them to know the shepherd. My son, he's turning seven, I think, seven next Sunday. He's got autism, and it's not the sort of typical autism, so it's a bit hard. You probably know it, but he goes to a school and for special needs, and the taxi driver comes to pick him up each morning, and he's very clearly Muslim, and so is the helper lady. They're dressed in the garb, and I don't know what they make of this, but often Gabriel's sort of just stuck with anxiety, and I say to him, only because I've learned this, I said, Gabriel, but Jesus is with you. He died for you, and he's with you today in school. I don't know what the guy thinks of that, but I say he's with you all the time. And I don't know if Gabriel knows that, but it's true. I can trust God with my children, that he's with them and he's their shepherd. And it's because of this truth. He's a shepherd that never forsakes you. He's there and he'll guide you through. I want to read you just the last chapter of a book. It's actually free to read. It's called Ordinary Pastor. You can download it off the internet for free, or you can buy a hard copy. It's written by a guy called Don Carson. Now, Don Carson, if you're not into theology and everything, like at Bible college, we read his books. He was the guy to listen to. He's an influential guy, and he's written a book about someone that's not known at all, his father. And you can see there's that legacy. And it's a small book, and it's written about a man that never got a congregation bigger than 50, that struggled in ministry, especially dealing in Canada with French and English speaking people. And he writes this at the end about his dad. Let me read this to you. Here we go. We don't know what his last words were because no one was there. When he died, there were no crowds outside the hospital, no editorial comments in the papers, no announcements on television, no mention in Parliament, no attention paid by the nation. In his hospital room, there was no one by his bedside. There was only the quiet hiss of oxygen, vainly venting because he had stopped breathing and would never need it again. But on the other side, all the trumpets sounded. Dad won, entrance to the only throne room that matters. Not because he was a good man or a great man. He was, after all, just an ordinary pastor. But because he was a forgiven man, and he heard the voice of him, of whom he longed to hear, saying, "Well done, good and faithful servant," and entered into the joy of the Lord forever. That's what matters. Amen.